Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a couple of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tragedy in Norway and speak with a Norwegian cultural anthropologist, Dr. Tuna Brinker, to try to find an explanation for how such callous and methodical mayhem could occur in a country famous for its tolerance, social peace, and cohesion. Then Dr. Thomas Hegghammer, a senior research fellow at the Norwegian Defence Research Establishment, joins us to help explain how the mass murderer was able to kill so many young people for so long, how he got his weapons and explosives, and what motivated the killer. Dr. Hegghammer is quoted in Sunday's New York Times pointing out the irony that the killer's manifesto is an exact mirror image of Al-Qaeda's declarations and manifestos. Then finally, Congressman Alan Grayson joins us to try to make sense of the economic hostage crisis in Washington, D.C., that has the president being whipsawed by Republican walkouts and blackmail to extract concessions by threatening to crash the economy. We will talk about Congressman Grayson's nationwide petition at no-cuts.com, demanding that there be no cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Let's now go to the interview I conducted shortly before coming on the air with Dr. Tuna Brinker, who's a professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Bergen in Norway. We had a bad phone connection, and she had to run out to enjoy her vacation in Vermont. So we'll begin with what we have. Dr. Brinker, as an anthropologist, you would not expect to examine your own tribe, as it were. But it does seem what happened in Norway goes against all that we in the rest of the world think about Norway. It seems very, shall we say, unusual to begin with.
Yes, certainly. And that's the reaction, I think, most Norwegians as well, certainly. I was stunned when I learned about this. And I thought, actually, I have to tell you how I learned about it, because I was arriving at Boston Airport from Norway. And at the passport control, the officer, he saw my passport and he said, Norway. He said, I just got some news out of Norway, Oslo. And I said, I hope they're not bad news. And he said, well, indeed they are. There was a terrorist attack. And I just could not believe that I heard correct. And I thought he must have gotten the place wrong. And then he opened sight and turned the screen towards me so that I could read. And it was just dumbstruck, and I think this is the reaction of most Norwegians.
Well, of course, there is a similarity here with what happened in Oklahoma City back in 1995, in the sense that when that bombing, which killed 168 Americans, among them children, the first reaction in this country was, of course, that it was Islamic terrorists. And I take it that was the first reaction in Norway as well?
Well, actually, it wasn't. They were very careful, as I understand it, the police and others, to say that they were not sure that this was the case. And I think the reason was the target. And I had the reaction when I read this website at the airport in Boston, that it was the attack of the youth summer camp of the governing Labour Party. I immediately thought this cannot be Islamic terrorism. This must be somebody who knows Norway very well and attacks something that's very specific to Norway and Norwegian post-war history. It's so this camp, these summer camps of Labour Party, has a very specific position in Norwegian post-war history, and it's very closely linked with the education of the new political elite that put in place the social democracy in Norway as we know it today, and also trained the coming ruling, the government, you know, like the prime minister, the current prime minister, he went to these camps as a youth, and all the leading figures in the Labour Party, all since the Second World War, who is actually built the Norway we know today. Very specific. that he attacked that, and he had to know this. The person had to know this.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Tuna Bringer, who's a professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Bergen in Norway. Clearly, it's difficult to understand the motivation of this person who did such a hideous thing. He did, apparently, in his manifesto entitled 2083, A European Declaration of Independence, where he equates liberalism and multiculturalism with cultural Marxism and suggests that they're out to destroy European Christianity and civilization. And he also refers to a meeting that may well be mythical that took place in London in 2002, where the Knights of the Templar, the Crusaders, got together to form a counterweight to Islamic influence, if you will. So does that fit in with your understanding of this man's political attack on the Norwegian social safety net represented by the Labour Party?
Well, he's clearly also has an ideology of inspired by, I don't know what to call it, but it's clearly, I would say probably ethnic purity. And he is not alone in propagating this kind of fear of, you know, Christian civilization, they're going to be overrun by Islam and so on. And I recognize this from, I'm an anthropologist and I worked in the Balkans and in during the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina, where there was a lot of this kind of rhetoric about protecting Christian civilization from Muslims. So there's a Muslim population there that were the victims, main victims of the war. And I just think that this kind of fear and hate mongering and rhetoric, you know, it does have some sort of audience. It has an audience in Europe, and there are far-right parties that are gaining terrain, which I find scary because, of course, it's both sides of the fence. The extremists, they feed on each other, and they feed on each other's rhetoric, and above all, they feed on fear. So if you can manage to create fear in a population, you know, they can win support. And I think now in Norway there will be a lot of discussion about how we talk about the others, as it were, in inverted commas, how we talk about our new citizens, non-Christian, non-European. And I think also it was actually surprising that this happened in Norway, because the leadership in Norway has been very prudent in how they have approached the problem of Norwegians who are scared and fear the new immigrants in some ways. And I just think that what is very important now is that we do not we're not pushed into this kind of or let ourselves be forced into this kind of fear rhetoric. I think that always fear precedes hatred.
Yes, indeed.
And if you can create an atmosphere of fear, the next will be, you know, people start hating what they fear. And this is what I saw in the war in Bosnia. And that's what I see now. And I think that it's very, very important that his kind of rhetoric, that we do not engage in that kind of rhetoric of fear and hatred.
Well, this may well prove to be difficult given the blow that was struck at the heart of the Labour Party, this brutal attack on the children of the Labour Party elite, and the fact that this fellow that perpetrated it was a member of the right-wing Progress Party, which apparently is similar to the Tea Party here in the United States, in as much as it began as an anti-tax protest but then became very stridently anti-immigrant.
Yes, but I hope that the leaders of the Progress Party, I haven't seen, say, also will come out and maybe rethink their strategies and their use of rhetoric. Now, this person, of course, is not a representative of the Progress Party, but his kind of ideas can play off in certain parts, I think, of this electorate. But he, of course, is also tied up with it's actually his main sphere of where he has been. Can I say the internet? Really, that's been his arena, and he's hooked up with other fellow thinkers, you know, in Europe. And so it's this combination, I think, of living out his fantasies in the internet, and then hooking up. He doesn't. I wouldn't say that he has. I wouldn't say he has any support for these really crazy. That they're really completely crazy ideas and so out of touch with reality. But what I'm thinking is that the Norwegian, I think, just media, and I think there will be discussion about that, and politicians, and we have to sit down and think about how we talk about our political opponents, but also how we talk about Muslims and Islam in particular, because this is the new kind of set up as the new front line in European politics.
Well, indeed, you've got examples next door in Sweden with the far-right Sweden Democrats just being elected. You've got Marine Le Pen, the daughter of the founder of the far-right party, the National Front in France, and and other countries, of course. We've had in the Netherlands, we've had killings of critics of Islam, and in France, of course, a fiercely secular state, you've had banning the veils. So already you have within Europe manifestations of this tensions. And your sense, I take it, is, Dr. Tunabringer, that this could actually have a paradoxically a beneficial effect in terms of healing some of these divides or warning people about going down that path. It's particularly poignant that you should have experienced all this personally in the Balkans.
Yes, yes, exactly. I'm very concerned about. I recognize, you know, these processes and the steps in this, in the process, you know, about going first you start formulating in the public sphere, you know, leaders, politicians, intellectuals, so-called, these kind of ideas that hook up with myths. And old European mythology, and you mentioned, you know, the guy who did all the killings and the Templars and all that. I mean, it was the same in the Balkans, and they hook up with really old kind of European mythical Christian mythology, and you know, the fight with the Muslims and the Ottomans and so on. And it's dangerous, but you see that if you first, and particularly, I think, if you're in a context of now, we don't have that in Norway now. You know, it's a stable country. We do not have an economic crisis. But when you have if there's certain moments in history when things come together, you know, you may have a very, in the former Yugoslavia, you know, the state was disintegrating. The economy was really very, very bad. And people didn't know, you know, couldn't plan the next day, you know, whether they would have enough money to buy bread and things. So there was a lot of insecurity. And then if you then have politicians who move into this kind of context and start using the rhetoric of fear, you know, and blaming the others, of course, there's always an others to blame, it becomes quite dangerous. Fear is our biggest enemy.
Well, you also have, I think, the economic conditions that you referred to in the Balkans, of course, were similar to the economic conditions in Weimar Germany that led to the rise of the Nazis. And unfortunately, things, particularly with the possibility or the likelihood that Greece will default, there may well be some economic problems in the south of Europe in the near future, it would seem. But let's just to sort of wrap up here, Dr. Tunabringer, again, professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Bergen in Norway, just to for our audience to understand what little we know and what we can assume about the motivations of this mass murderer who apparently was able to shoot these young members of the Labour Party elite I think he was there for 90 minutes. It took the police 40 minutes to arrive, and frankly, that's hard to understand. But I think, if you don't mind explaining the historical context here of how, during World War II, the right wing allied themselves with the Nazi occupiers, leading to the leader being Quisling. It's become a word in the vernacular for a traitor and a puppet. And that the post-war Labour Party were the ones that created the social safety net, the social democracy that that Norway represents. In fact, one of the, I think, the leading examples of it in the world today.
Yes, that is correct. And you know, I don't know where he comes from and what kind of ideas he's fed on, except what I read in the newspapers. But I don't see him as a... He's apparently not a neo-Nazi, because we did have, in the 80s, we had some... There was an attack on a first of May, which is a parade on the 1st of May, the Workers' Union, International Workers' Day in Norway, where there was a bomb, and one of the guards was injured. He lost a hand. And this was in the 80s when we had a neo-Nazi movement, groupings in Norway. So they've been there. I mean, these right-wingers, they're far-right-wingers that have links to this the Norwegian Nazi past during the Second World War. And they were, you know, the white supremacists, I guess you could say they were, you know, reveling in Norwegian or ancient Norwegian history and Norse mythology and so on, and you know, the Aryan sort of blonde, blue-eyed supremacy of the Northern Europeans in a way. And so I don't know, I haven't read anything that he has any connections to the neo-Nazi milieu, but of course some of these ideas are very closely linked to some of the more, but it's in a modern, you know,
right,
context with it turns sort of against immigration, and I'm not quite clear. He sounds very confused, this man, and it's hard to say where it comes from, but I guess it's the same, you know, you have in you also had in U.S. after the Oklahoma, you know, you think, okay, so the U.S., that, and what they would say in Europe, you have to look at American society to understand how, you know, a person like this could be, he's a product of American society in a way, you know, I think that the comments were in Europe. And I've tried to think about this, you know, this guy, is he a product of Norwegian society in a way he is, but what kind of, what is it about Norwegian society that's produced this kind of man? But you see, he could have been produced in the U.S., in any country, I guess, in Europe and the Western world, you know, and it's difficult. I think it's early days yet to know, really.
Well, he's more of a reaction to Norwegian society than a product of it, isn't he? Isn't
yes.
he? He's striking against it. I mean, I take it that your first instincts were not similar to what happened here in the United States when Oklahoma City happened. Everybody assumed it was the Islamists, and the first reports out of Norway were that it was Islamists. But I take it, because you knew about this Labour Party camp, and you immediately assumed that this was a right-wing attack on the heart of Norwegian social democracy.
Yes, because it wouldn't have been, I mean, it was so specific, and it has such a specific position in Norwegian history, and this camp, and who would know about it? I mean, so who was not particularly wanting to target, and of course he also targeted the government buildings and the building where that houses the prime minister. So it was definitely he wanted to actually kill the future political leadership of the country,
which he may well have done.
He may well have done. You know, there will be, I've heard some of the interviews with these young people. And also, by the way, it's important to note that these kids, you know, you think it happened in Oslo, but they come from all over Norway. So it's really, it was a microcosm of Norway's youth. They come from all the counties of Norway, across Norway. So every county, every little township, you know, have maybe lost someone. And it's a small country, 4 million people, closely knit, and so it also pulls Norway together. I think it's not just an Oslo thing; it's the whole country, and it says something about, you know, how leadership is recruited. It's not only recruited from the capital; it is genuinely, you know, recruited from all over Norway, from more communities, from cities, and so on. And by the way, I'd like to just say, at the end here, I was so moved because I'm in this small town in Vermont called Townsend. And yesterday I drove past this small store, as an antique store, and they'd put out a Norwegian flag.
Mm. Well, I thank you for joining us as an anthropologist to explain to us your culture and what an obscene anomaly this is in your country. And also, I think we're particularly grateful for the fact that you have had personal experience in the dark side of humanity from the Balkans, and which serves as a warning that perhaps that out of this hideous tragedy maybe some sanity may emerge.
Yes, I hope so.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today,
Dr.
Tuna Bringa. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tuna Bringa, who is a professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Bergen in Norway. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a fellow from the Norwegian Defense Establishment to try and explain how this assassin was able to get arms and uniforms, etc. So stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Thomas Hegghammer, who's a senior research fellow with the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment and a fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Hegghammer.
Thank you.
And I wish it were under better circumstances. Clearly, this is an extraordinary tragedy. And what is your explanation for something that is quite puzzling, and that is the enormously tardy response from the police? I think the killer was able to fire at people for some 90 minutes, and the police arrived 40 minutes after they were called. Is there any explanation for this?
Well, yes. The main explanation is that is the bombing that he set off beforehand. So he detonated an enormous ammonium nitrate bomb just outside the Prime Minister's office in the center of Oslo, which caused tremendous damage and rocked the capital. And that bombing alone, you know, was completely unprecedented by Norwegian standards. So that upset the entire country and mobilized most Oslo police, I suspect. And then the shooting started 2 hours later, and by that time, most police were sort of were busy cleaning up the bombing site in the center. So that bombing acted as a distraction for the police, and I have no doubt that the attacker intended it to be that. That way, so that he could kill people more easily at the youth convention.
And the fact that he arrived by ferry, dressed in a police uniform, and then apparently there was, I think, one or two policemen at the Labour Party youth camp who were the first people that he shot. And my question would be then, if my understanding was that the Prime Minister was about to arrive at this youth camp. So here in the United States, of course, if the President shows up anywhere, the Secret Service advance team are there in advance. So is there an explanation for that, for why there wasn't more security, given that the Prime Minister was due to arrive?
Personally, I don't know the precise details of the Prime Minister's schedule. My understanding was that he was due to speak quite a lot later that day. In any case, by the time the shooting started, the country was already at a state of high alert, and the Prime Minister would have been in a secret location, et cetera. So that could be part of the reason for that. But you mentioned that there were police on the island. But we have to bear in mind that in Norway, police are unarmed as a rule, and they're only allowed to bring out their weapons if they face someone who is armed. So the default equipment for Norwegian police doesn't include weapons.
But that's not to say, surely, Dr. Thomas Hegheimer, that Norway is not a country with a high percentage, I believe, for Europe, a high percentage of gun ownership. The NRA, of course, here in this country has encouraged gun ownership to the point of insanity, I think. At least that's my opinion. I understand that Norway for a European country, has pretty lax gun laws. Is that correct?
Well, personally, I'm not familiar with the gun laws in other countries in Europe. I do know that there are fairly tight restrictions on weaponry, and that you, as a rule, you're only allowed to own weapons if you hunt, or if you are a member of a gun club.
And he was a member of a gun club, was he not, this fellow?
Well, he was, and he in fact acquired both the handguns he used on that island. A semi-automatic rifle and a Glock pistol. Both those weapons he acquired legally by filing an application in advance and obtaining a permission and then buying it using his permission. And his, according to his own manifesto, which appeared on the internet yesterday, he obtained those weapons by saying that he would use the rifle for deer hunting, and the Glock pistol for marksmanship.
And did he go in his manifesto, which I believe is titled 2083, a European Declaration of Independence, where he goes on to liken liberalism and multiculturalism in Norway as a form of Marxist ideology, and says it's out to destroy European Christian civilization. Did he mention in his manifesto how he purchased tons of ammonium nitrate?
Yes, he did. The manifesto is 1,500 pages long and has an extraordinary amount of detail about the entire preparation process. He explains everything that he did from the very beginning, from when he first started thinking about doing something like this in the early 2000s to the beginning of his operational planning in 2010, and for the sort of the last phase of the preparation, so the last 100 days, he has a very, very detailed log of his activities, almost by the hour, and he explains in detail what he bought, where he bought it from, and so on. Really quite an extraordinary document.
And again, Dr. Thomas Hegheimer is a senior research fellow with the Norwegian Defence Research Establishment and a fellow at the Centre on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. Did he, assassin, one of the pictures of him, I believe it's on the internet, shows him with what looks like a military weapon with a scope, and he appears to be dressed in some special forces military uniform. Was he ever in the Norwegian military?
I don't know for certain, but I don't think he was. In his manifesto, he provides quite a lot of biographical detail, autobiographical detail, and he says that he he did not serve in the armed forces. But clearly he had a strong interest in weapons and in military culture.
And he was able to apparently get a police uniform.
Yes, he did. He did. He also explains in detail how he did that. He had fake badges made in Prague, so as not to attract attention by Scandinavian authorities. So he went to great lengths to document his activities. Which of course makes the investigation quite a lot easier.
So in his manifesto, Dr. Heghammer, does he talk about his membership in the right-wing Progress Party, which in Norway began as an anti-tax protest party, rather like the Tea Party here in the United States, and has since become very, aggressively anti-immigrant?
Yes, he does. He explains that he was a member, a fairly active member of its youth branch in the early 2000s. But he also explains that he quickly grew disillusioned with the party. He came to consider them as too moderate and essentially as too heavily sort of influenced by this sort of what he calls it, the sort of Marxist multiculturalist paradigm. Basically, saw them as being too soft on multiculturalism.
So, of course, when this first happened, there was a similar response as there was here in the United States back in 1995, with the Oklahoma City bombing, where the first initial response in the U.S. and particularly in the media was that this has to be Islamic terrorism, and I assume that given that the proximity of the bomb to a newspaper that published the infamous Danish cartoons, maybe there was similar speculation in Norway. Was that your understanding?
Oh yeah. I think most people inside and outside Norway initially suspected militant Islamist involvement in this bombing. Of course. When the shooting started, then things became less clear because the shooting sprees at youth party conventions is not something that we've seen before in the sort of jihadi modus operandi. And then soon after that, we started hearing reports about the physical appearance of the shooter and then later on, the police confirmed that he was indeed an ethnic Norwegian someone with right-wing sympathies.
Which I imagine resulted in similar soul-searching that went on here in the United States. How could this be homegrown?
Absolutely. And obviously, people are now raising questions about whether there has been too much of a focus on Islamist militancy at the expense of right-wing militancy. Personally, my view is that so long as we don't have evidence that the shooter was part of a community or of an organization, I don't think that is a fair accusation. Because if this person was a loner, as he indeed seems to have been, then it's more difficult to blame the security services because. Complete lone wolves are extremely difficult to spot in advance.
Well, our previous guest here today, Dr. Thomas Heghammer, again, senior research fellow with the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment and a fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. We started out with Dr. Tuna Bringer, who's a anthropologist, cultural anthropologist at the University of Bergen, she said that her first reaction was not that it was an Islamist because of what happened on the island. She knew the island. She knew its relationship to the ruling Labour Party. And she thought it was particularly important to understand the history of Norwegian politics going back to World War II, where during the Nazi occupation, the right in Norway were the Quislings, as you well know, and that the post-war Labour Party were the ones that developed the social democracy that Norway has. And somebody that had this right-wing Christian fundamentalist bent that this assassin apparently had would be making a profound political statement by attacking not just the Labour Party, but the Labour Party youth wing, the very children of the Labour Party elite and future Labour Party leaders of Norway.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, every Norwegian knows the significance of this youth conference. It has a long history. And as soon as we heard about the shooting at this island called Utøya, we suspected that whoever planned this had, you know, an intimate knowledge of Norwegian political culture, and so that made the sort of the theory of the hypothesis of a jihadi plot less likely. In addition to the fact that, you know, had it been Al Qaeda or another jihadi group, presumably they would have sought to punish the government for some foreign policy. And in that case, one would have expected them to perhaps attack the Labour Party's coalition partners in government, rather than the youth branch of one party in government. So several factors which made the shooting spree on the island kind of point us in a right-wing direction.
Well, you're quoted in Sunday's New York Times, Dr. Hegghammer, as saying that his manifesto, the killer's manifesto, is a mirror of Al-Qaeda, exactly in reverse.
Yes, it is, in many ways. Sort of the fundamental grievance expressed in the manifesto is basically against what the attacker sees as a Muslim invasion, a creeping invasion of Europe, a dilution of European Christian values, and his objective is not to kill all Muslims or to kill all non-whites. It's merely, if I may, to expel all Muslims and to purify European territory of Muslim influence. And in many ways, this is precisely the discourse of Al-Qaeda in reverse. They want to sort of purify Muslim land of non-Muslim influence and to throw out all Western military forces and diplomats and so on in the name of sort of a pan-Islamic nationalism, if you will.
So I take it then that in the subsequent political debate that will take place and probably is already taking place in Norway, there will be, I imagine it will put the right-wing party on the defensive, will it not? But of course there's a phenomenon throughout a lot of Europe, and right next door in Sweden, you have the Swedish Democrats, the far-right party, having entered the parliament. You've got in France, the daughter of the National Front leader, Le Pen, making some kind of political inroads. So in general, there is a kind of right-wing drift. And in Norway, is it in any way connected to Norway's participation, or the backlash, I should say, to Norway's participation in Afghanistan and in Libya, as it happens at the moment?
Well, I think the particular kind of political movement into which this attacker fits is pan-European. It's a phenomenon that you see across Europe and has more to do with resistance to foreign cultural influence than with any country's foreign policy. Since 9/11 and before, there has been an increasing hostility to Muslims across Europe, and growing hostility to or growing demand for tougher restrictions on immigration and so on, this sentiment has been growing, I would say, and this attacker is a very, very extreme expression of this sentiment. So here again we see a parallel with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda taps into a fairly widely held sentiment in the Muslim world that Muslims are suffering under sort of Western imperialism. But the solution that they prescribe is really outrageous and not accepted by the majority of Muslims. Here, similarly with this attacker, he taps into a sentiment that's fairly widespread, but his solution is very, very extreme.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Thomas Hegghammer.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Thomas Hegghammer, Senior Research Fellow with the Norwegian Defence Research Establishment and a fellow at the Centre on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Congressman Grayson. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Alan Grayson, who represented Florida's 8th Congressional District in the U.S. Congress until 2011. As a congressman, Alan Grayson received significant attention for his strong stance on ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and holding politicians and bankers accountable. He authored the Grayson-Himes Pay for Performance Act, which placed limits on bonuses paid to executives of banks that had received federal bailout money. Recently, he has been asking voters nationwide to sign a petition at no-cuts.com demanding that there be no cuts to Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. You can sign up at no-cuts.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Grayson.
Thank you.
And the music introducing her, the lunatic fringe, was a suggestion that the lunatics have taken over the asylum. I frankly, Congressman, find it absolutely astounding that somehow the Democrats, and perhaps the problem is that the press is biased in favor of the Republicans. But why isn't it clear that what's going on in Washington is an economic hostage crisis that has the president being whipsawed by Republican walkouts and blackmail to extract concessions by threatening to crash the economy?
Well, I think it's clear to the public. I think the polling reflects that the public overwhelmingly is opposed to cuts in Medicare, Social Security, or Medicaid benefits. In order to get past this artificial crisis, it's Naomi Klein's shock doctrine come to life once again. The right wing is trying to force on us cuts that we'd never agree to under any rational circumstances by fomenting an artificial crisis.
So why from the beginning then did the president tie the economy to this phony issue of the debt?
Well, the president has his point of view. Other people have their point of view. The fact is that Social Security and Medicare are the only parts of the government that actually run at a profit. You won't see the military running a bake sale anytime soon in order to raise funds. But Social Security and Medicare consistently, over the course of generations, have brought in more money than they've spent, to the tune of over $2 trillion in the case of Social Security alone. Social Security has run at a profit for, what, 70-plus years in a row? And yet the wailing from the right is that we somehow have to cut these programs in order to remain solvent, when in fact the problem is obviously elsewhere. We spent $157 billion last year on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The number of wars since then has gone up by 50%. In addition to that, we gave back $90 billion last year and another almost $100 billion this year by extending the Bush tax cuts for the rich. If you were at all serious about trying to save $2 trillion over the course of the next 10 years, that's where you would look first. But in fact, those aren't the real problems that face us. The real problems that face us is that we've got 23 million Americans right now who can't find full-time work, which actually is a larger number than the number of unemployed Americans during the Great Depression. We have 50 million Americans, according to the CDC, who cannot see a doctor when they're sick because they have no health coverage. And we have 15 million American families who owe more on their mortgage than the value of their property. They're underwater, as the saying goes, and they feel like they're drowning. Those are the real problems that Congress should be facing right now and trying to solve, not this artificial debt crisis, which involves some kind of preoccupation verging on an obsession over what the deficit might or might not be in the year 2021.
But Congressman, you're running again for the seat in Central Florida in 2012. And in 2008, 140 million Americans voted. In 2010, 2 years later, only 75 million voted. The people that you just referred to who don't have health care and who are being abandoned in this country, the point is they've got to be inspired to vote, surely. I mean, you lost your seat because the same people that voted for you the first time didn't show up 2 years later.
Right. It wasn't just a random sample of those 140 million who didn't vote. The Republican turnout in my district and all through Florida was just short of what the Republican turnout was 2 years earlier in 2008. The Democratic turnout was almost down by half. The Republican turnout was in the mid-60s. The Democratic turnout was in the low 40s. So it's the Democrats who stayed home in 2010. Because I guess many of them felt that they hadn't seen change and they were out of hope. And I understand that. But the fact remains that if you don't vote, then you don't count. And the people who are facing these crushing blows in terms of federal benefits are the very people who in many cases didn't bother to vote. And if Democrats don't vote, then Democrats can't win. In 2008, I got more votes than any other candidate in the history of Central Florida. And in 2010, I lost by 18 points. And it wasn't me. I mean, it wasn't me that led all these people to decide not to vote all through Florida, and not just in Florida, but in Oklahoma, in Michigan, in Ohio. We lost 5 seats in Illinois, 4 seats in Ohio. You know, all over the country except for New England and California, Democrats just didn't show up. So we ended up with this arch right-wing extremist House of Representatives majority because people like me were replaced by people like Ellen West. That's the right kind of government you get. And, you know, as Ed Koch said after his last election, the people have voted and now they'll be punished for it. And that's what we've seen.
Right. Well, but the country's getting punished. I mean, the idea that they're threatening to pull the whole house down. Again, I'm speaking with Congressman Alan Grayson, who has a nationwide petition at no-cuts.com demanding there be no cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And of course, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're a very wealthy man, so you're actually calling for you want to have your taxes cut. I take it. But tell me about, because you were in the Congress, my understanding that these meetings where the president gets whipsawed and Cantor walks out and then Boehner walks out, my understanding that Cantor is a very combative representative of the Tea Party, and he was apparently quite disrespectful to President Obama, which is the Tea Party are obviously in public incredibly disrespectful. They call him a Muslim terrorist without a birth certificate, etc. So, has this reached that level of acrimony Because the problem that I see the president has is that he can't really call their bluff, and they apparently are pretty crazy. They're acting crazy, at least. That if they brought the whole house down, he'd be stuck with a devastated economy to run on in 2012, and presumably you'd be also running on this devastated economy. So walk me through those steps.
You know, I think that it's a trap to fall into the idea that somehow it's a function of personalities. It goes a lot deeper than that. I don't think that we should be thinking too much about whether the president and John Boehner have a good round of golf together. What we should be thinking about is the fact that without Medicare, there's a lot of old, sick people who are going to die. Without Medicaid, there's a lot of poor, sick people who are going to die. Without Social Security, many people are going to have to work until the day that they die. That's way, way more important to me than anything regarding the personal interactions between Eric Cantor, who's a tool, by the way, a tool of Wall Street, and other special interests. And the President of the United States. It just doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that we do our best to meet our promises to the people who we've made promises to and to help people in need.
Well, Eric Cantor was recently on Wall Street before the group of speculators who have run up the price of oil and gas, promising that that if they got back in 2012, took over the presidency and the Senate and had the trifecta, that they would eviscerate further the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission. But just back to the economic hostage crisis going on here in Washington D.C. I take it that many people feel, and perhaps you do too, Congressman Grayson, that the worst thing that could happen is that the president agrees to what he's apparently put on the table.
Well, I don't think the president should have ever put on the table any cuts in benefits for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's why we created our website, nocuts.com, no-cuts.com, to invite people to sign our petition. And I will take it to the White House if we get 100,000 signatures. And being a former member of Congress, I can probably get in. But the fact is that it's utterly misguided. I can't fathom the delight that some people on the right seem to have in hurting people who need help. There is no rational reason to cut benefits here if you actually wanted to make sure that the system continued to bring in more than it pays out, which it's done for over 70 years, every single year for over 70 years. There's all sorts of ways to accomplish that, but bear in mind the system is currently solvent through 2037. I'm not probably going to live until 2037, and many of the people I know are not going to be alive in the year 2037.
Well,
if it starts to run a deficit in the year 2037, I think we have more pressing problems to deal with. But there's almost a sadistic element to the right wing's fascination with cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting Medicaid. They really want to hurt the people who need the help the most.
Well, it's particularly galling, though, Congressman Grayson, that some of these people, I saw an ad with Mike Huckabee, who is apparently overtly religious man, who was a preacher in one of his incarnations. And I don't understand how people who advertise themselves as Christians could be go against the teaching of the prophet Jesus, who ministered to the poor, the sick, and he didn't hate homosexuals, carry an assault rifle, ask poor people for money, and go on television shaking down everybody. I mean, why not call these people on their so-called Christian family values?
Well, I think we should. I mean, I feel that the decisions that I make are rooted in a 3,000-year-old tradition. The decisions that I make are ones where we try to shelter the homeless and feed the hungry and heal the sick. That's the whole point of it all, to help the people who are facing problems that are just too big for them to solve themselves. If you have one person who's unemployed, maybe that one person can find a job. If you have 23 million people who are unemployed, there's no way they can all find a job without some kind of help. It's just not possible. And over again, people are put into the meat grinder that we've created, this unbridled capitalistic system that destroys people's lives time and time again by having promoting a war of all against all. That's where we are right now, and that's where the right wing wants to push us even further, further into the clutches of a system that just doesn't give a damn about any of us except to the extent that we provide cheap labor.
And in the case of that I referred to with Huckabee, he was in a commercial telling people to vote down or to repeal what he calls Obamacare. So it's not just that they want to deny people, they want to actually take away the little gains that have been made. So it is a battle, and I do hope people on the left in this country join the battle and don't abdicate. I thank you for joining us today, Congressman Alan Grayson.
You're welcome. We've had a lot of people come to our website, congressmanwithguts.com, and join that battle. We had over 80,000 contributors in the last campaign, the largest number in the entire Democratic Party. And if people sign up for emails, help the campaign through contributing or volunteering, then they're doing something good and showing that they care and that they're involved. They're showing that they have both a head and a heart.
Again, I've been speaking with Congressman Alan Grayson. He has a petition out now at no-cuts.com. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with a Norwegian cultural anthropologist, Dr. Tuna Bringa, to try and find out how this country that's kind of a model for its tolerance and social peace and cohesion could have become the site of such a callous and hideous slaughter. But she pointed out very quickly that she didn't think for 1 minute that this was an Islamic terrorist plot, because she knew from the island where it took place that it was a youth labor camp from the ruling Labor Party, and that there's a history. Anybody in Norway would know that during World War II, the right wing allied themselves with the Nazi occupiers, thus the famous Quisling, and that after the war, the Labor Party created the modern social democracy, and that anybody that was a right winger in that country would have been striking at the heart of the social democracy of Norway, and she immediately assumed that that's what it was. It was a local act of political terrorism, which it turned out to be. It was particularly moving that she should have talked to us, because she spent a lot of time in the Balkans working with NGOs during the Bosnian War and was able to describe the results of that kind of hatred, where fear engenders hatred and leads to murder and mayhem. And then we continued the conversation with Dr. Thomas Hegghammer, as a former research fellow with the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment. I wanted to know from him how the mass murderer was able to kill so many people for so long, and where he got his weapons and the fertilizer to make the bombs. And he was able to answer all those questions, which, by the way, are on the manifesto that this fellow put up on the internet, the assassin. Apparently, he's done all the police legwork for them. He's described in huge detail how he planned and executed this mayhem. And then finally, we spoke with Congressman Alan Grayson, who is out to with a nationwide petition at no-cuts.com demanding that there be no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Of course, we talked about what's the economic hostage crisis going on in Washington. And he is the leader of Congressmen with Guts, and he is a Congressman with Guts, and he spared no prisons and said it exactly what it is. A very inspiring conversation with Congressman Alan Grayson. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This has been Background Briefing. You can sign up for podcasts at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The